Good morning, Council. Welcome to the, you may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. We have six cases on our calendar. This is the second of four set for oral argument. This is case number A22-1063, Thomas Robert Tichnich. Is that how it's pronounced? Tichnich. Okay. Versus State of Minnesota. Council, each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial oral argument, starting with appellant, and then respondent after that, and then appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose to use that. This proceeding is being recorded via audio. No other recordings are permitted. We have a podium in the middle that has a button just underneath to lower and raise it. And when you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Stacey Bettison, appearing on behalf of appellant Mr. Thomas Tichnich. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Bettison and I represent the appellant Mr. Thomas Tichnich. Mr. Tichnich recognizes the reluctance of this court to overturn convictions absent some glaring error that could not be addressed until post-conviction. We believe that this case presents such errors. There are several issues presented in the papers, and I'd like to turn first to legally inconsistent verdicts. And this is a really important issue. It needs guidance from this court and a clear ruling from this court. There's something wrong here, and we are looking to you to address it. And we know that there's conflict in how it's being applied, this issue, because of State v. Well, out of Blue Earth County, which we've cited in the papers, where Judge Johnson had to look outside of Minnesota jurisdiction to decide whether at a bench trial he could issue a verdict of both attempt and completion for CSC 3. He did not look at State v. Noggle, though, and we believe that that is an important case that guides the question of whether an attempted crime and a completed crime presents a legally inconsistent verdicts.
Counsel, on that issue, why is it legally inconsistent to have both? It seems to me that you are presuming that an attempt must end in a failure of it, but why can't an attempt result in a completion of the crime? It seems to me that you could go down either path and either one would be okay. And if you have an attempt and a completion, you still could have that attempt there, but you would also then have the completion of the crime.
Yes, thank you for the question. Well, what we know about Minnesota law is it requires that the crime of attempt be connected to an uncompleted substantive crime, and that's State v. Noggle. And what is the uncompleted substantive crime here? There is none. And then to be candid with you, from the moment these verdicts were delivered, Mr. Tichnich and others were confused by them. The one question was, were there two victims, one for the attempt and one for the completion? Another was, how can there only be one reasonable inference of which would be completed penetration, when the verdicts prove that there are at least two reasonable inferences? One was that it was just attempted, and the other that it was completed. And so one option is to look at these and say, yeah, they're just, it's one and two and they're fine. Attempt is lesser included, that's the end of the analysis. And that's certainly what the post-conviction court did.
Now, but not that I'm necessarily trying to avoid addressing the issue, but isn't that issue NAFLA barred?
legally inconsistent verdicts?
Correct. Because this is based on information that was known at the time of trial.
Certainly. The verdicts were known at the time of trial, and they were not raised at trial as error, and they were not raised on direct appeal. And we have said that our argument is that it's not NAFLA barred. Mr. Tichich has raised an ineffective assistance of counsel for his counsel not raising these at trial and not raising them on direct appeal. His trial counsel and appellate counsel was the same. And we did include in the petition Mr. Tichich's affidavit that said he had raised the issue of legally inconsistent verdicts to his appellate counsel, who was the same as his trial, and counsel declined to raise it on direct appeal. In any event,
isn't that trial strategy that we don't review?
Trial strategy, the trial was done, so there would be no strategic reason not to raise legally inconsistent verdicts. The trial was completed, and certainly there's no trial strategy to be had in not raising it on direct appeal.
The strategy would be that the claim is meritless. Why raise an issue that is not going to be successful?
We believe that the claim has merit, and so therefore there would be an effective assistance of counsel with a meritorious claim. In any event, we did file a supplemental authority that suggests in a recent case by this court issued on December 28th that because the post-conviction court looked at the procedural bar and then went on to the merits, that this court likewise should consider the merits of the legally inconsistent claim because the post-conviction court did too. And that was in our supplemental authority.
But just because this court does look at something that's procedural barred and then or statutorily time barred and then does look at the merits, that's really within the discretion of this court. If something is barred, either procedurally time barred or barred under NAFLA, the analysis can stop right there. There's no need to get into the substantive analysis, and we've got plenty of cases, both precedential and non-precedential, where we just stop with the bar.
Fair enough. Thank you. And what I would say is we briefed the NAFLA bar extensively in the papers to suggest that Mr. Tichich, or not to suggest, but to say that Mr. Tichich did raise this with his appellate counsel. Appellate counsel did not raise it on direct appeal. And this is the time to bring an ineffective assistance of counsel for having failed to raise the legally inconsistent verdict, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel is the time to raise it on post-conviction.
Go ahead.
Oh, which does that then require us to reach the merits of that claim in order to evaluate the
In order to determine whether there was ineffective assistance, the claim needs to have merit. And so I think that does require this court to look at the merits of the legally inconsistent verdict.
And if we were, fair enough, and if we were to conclude that the claims lack merit, that would mean that the ineffective assistance of counsel of trial and appellate counsel would fail then?
If legally inconsistent verdict does not have merit, I think the analysis would be then that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel for having not raised it on direct appeal. Okay.
One other question on this. You'd mentioned that you needed guidance from this court. What would be your syllabus point?
Yes. The syllabus point would be a guilty verdict for attempt and a guilty verdict for a completed crime are legally inconsistent. Stated another way, when a jury returns two verdicts, one for an attempt and one for a completed crime, the two verdicts are legally inconsistent. So there can be really no disputing back to the law that attempt is an inchoate crime that must be connected to an uncompleted substantive crime that was attempted. And that's from Noggle, which we cite at page 549. The primary question in Mr. Tichich's trial was, is this an attempt case or is this a penetration case? The state told the district court, the jury, and now they are telling this court that it's both. And you raised that question. But here, the state proved both a failed crime and they proved a completed crime. And we need to look at this issue really in the full landscape of Minnesota law. We have State versus Moore that says the proof of the elements of one offense negate an element of another. They legally inconsistent verdicts require two guilty verdicts, not one guilty and one not guilty. That would be a logically inconsistent issue. And why here are the verdicts legally inconsistent? The proof of the elements of attempt negate the element of completed penetration, which is the substantive crime. So attempt, the state has proved a failed crime, or more precisely, the state has proven a crime that requires a failed substantive crime, and that's Noggle.
So counsel, here's my question. So when we are evaluating whether the verdicts are legally inconsistent, am I correct that our inquiry is to look at the two statutes and determine what the elements of those statutes are and determine if there's an inconsistent element? And my question is because, you've cited case law to support the idea that the crime needs to be committed, but when I look at the statute itself for attempt, it seems that the elements, as the legislature has articulated them today, is intent and a substantial step. And so is there a reason why the inquiry does not stop with the statutory language itself?
Yes, there is, because attempt is, we know that attempt is a failed crime, and we know that for a variety of reasons. So the elements of attempt, though it's not in the statute, that's true, and that's the state's argument is, hey, all we have to prove is intent and substantial step, and we're done. But we know that that's not what an attempt is, and we know that from Noggle. We also know that from Dumas, which goes back to 1912, which articulated that attempt is but failing to accomplish it. Noggle says that attempt is an inchoate offense that must be connected to an uncompleted crime that was attempted. And also, if we look to the attempt statute, 60917 subdivision 2, the attempt is defined. Attempt is still a crime even if, quote, the commission of the crime was not possible. So we know it's
was Noggle applying 609.17 subdivision 1?
I don't know if it applies subdivision 1. Okay.
But for 609.17, that's in the context of affirmative defense, which is a different scenario, right?
Well, 60917 defines the crime of attempt.
Sub 1 defines.
Sub 1. Sub 2, right, sub 2 goes to, sub 3 goes to the defense, and it says that it is a defense to a charge of attempt that the crime, the quote, crime was not committed because the accused desisted voluntarily and in good faith and abandoned the intention to commit the crime. So we know just looking at the statute that yes, those two elements, intent and substantial step, those are the elements, but we know that the elements, the complete elements of attempt is that it is a failed crime.
But I think you're reading, I'm not sure if I agree with you, because when I look at subdivision 3, that's talking about an affirmative defense. An affirmative defense is not an element of the crime. So it seems like you're trying to bootstrap the statute regarding what is an affirmative defense and that definition there into a required element, and that's not part of what needs to be proved for an attempt.
That's true, but what this defense recognizes is that attempt is a failed crime. That's the elements of attempt is that by very nature of attempt, it was never completed.
That seems to be reading into the language of the elements that need to be proved under the statute, something that is not there.
Well, I would offer this as well, Judge Reyes, which is the advisory committee notes from 1963 that took out that failure out of the statute. They said that attempt is something which has failed in accomplishment, and they clarified the distinctive feature of an attempt is that an act is punished which itself was harmless, but which was designed to carry out a criminal purpose and failed of accomplishment. So even though they took out the failure out of the statute, the advisory committee notes recognize that attempt is a failed crime. And we also have Lewandowski from this court, which is that one cannot attempt a crime that has been completed. CrimJig 505, which the post-conviction court cited to, also supports that it is a failed crime because it says it's not a defense for a defendant to say, hey, look, I completed it. That actually supports our argument, which is the elements of attempt are that it is failed. And so by proving a failed crime, you cannot likewise prove an uncompleted crime. The authority that suggesting attempt is not a failed crime, there is none. And the state doesn't cite any. No case has ever adopted the state's reasoning. There's no authority for the state's argument. In fact, the state's argument tracks very closely the State v. Noggle from the Court of Appeals, which we know was overturned in the Supreme Court, State v. Noggle. Court of Appeals Noggle said attempt crimes are a violation of both the attempt statute and the crime attempted. And that's at page 2. Of course, we know that the Supreme Court overturned that decision. So importantly, the state here argues that they're not required to prove failure, which is your point, and we understand that because it's not part of the statutory construction of the attempt statute. However, to prove that the offense did not fail, that it was completed, it was required to prove the completion offense, they needed to prove that he didn't fail. And so that is where the legal inconsistency comes from. The essence of the problem is this. If a guilty verdict for attempt requires a failed substantive crime, and that's Noggle, it becomes impossible to prove that the statutory crime was committed. And so you have this tension between you can't prove the statutory crime was committed, your understanding. Okay, thank you. This is why they're mutually exclusive. We believe that the full Minnesota landscape covers what the attempt is and that it is a failed crime. And by looking beyond the statute, which we must do because courts interpret statutes, that the full landscape here shows that attempt contains the elements of a failed crime. And Noggle really explicitly says that.
And counsel, you're over time, so that's why I was indicating that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Counsel for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. First, I would like to just, since appellant did not address the false testimony claim, I think that's appropriate. I don't think there's much analysis or conversation that needs to be had on that issue, because this court just very recently issued its precedential opinion in Gilbert v. State, which is directly on point and dispositive of the false testimony claim.
So you would agree that under Gilbert, we would not apply the Rainier test or Rainier test, as you argued in your brief, that we apply the Larison test?
I understand the reasoning in Gilbert with why the court went with Larison, because that is what was advocated for by the appellant and what was analyzed by the post-conviction court. That is also the case in this case. And I do believe that the state prevails in this case under the Larison test because, as Gilbert says, there was no false testimony. I do think, however, you know, if this court was inclined to provide further clarification on when Rainier may apply in this type of scenario versus Larison, so in a scenario where there's an allegation of false testimony, but there is no falsity, that perhaps, you know, if this court was inclined to say that in those types of claims, Rainier is the more appropriate test for newly discovered evidence. There's an additional witness here, and do the four-prong analysis in Rainier. As I advocated in my briefing, I think that's appropriate as well. However, given the analysis in Gilbert,
And it does appear that argument was raised in Gilbert, that the Rainier test, that was my reading of the case. Was that yours as well?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
That the state raised a similar argument that the Rainier test rather than the Larson test should have been applied to our court in that case?
Correct. I know the state raised the Rainier test at the appellate level. I'm not sure if it was raised to the post-conviction court. And I did raise the two tests to the post-conviction court in this case, so that may be a difference. But I do agree that Gilbert is directly on point and dispositive of the claim. As for the other two claims raised by appellant on the inconsistent verdicts and the prosecutorial misconduct, both of those claims are NAFLA barred. And so this court needs to keep in mind the procedural posture of this case. Post-conviction claims are a collateral attack on a conviction that is final, and that that those convictions have a presumption of regularity. And so we do need to do the appropriate analysis of whether they can overcome the procedural hurdles of having the merits reviewed.
Well, I do think that the argument that's being made is that there's a non-NAFLA barred ineffective assistance of both trial and appellate counsel claim here. And in order to evaluate that claim, we need to evaluate the merits of the arguments that have been raised by appellants. Do you disagree with that analysis?
I disagree that the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim is not NAFLA barred. I would say that it is NAFLA barred. However, I do agree and concede that ineffective assistance of appellate counsel is not NAFLA barred because it could not have been raised at any time.
Why aren't we bound by our precedent in JAMA v. State that said that where trial and appellate counsel are the same, you can raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim on post-conviction appeal?
So my reading of JAMA is that when—and it gets complicated because there's so many layers—but when the claim is that the appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise an ineffective assistance of trial counsel, then those two can be wrapped together, and neither are NAFLA barred, and they both can be raised. Here, my understanding of appellant's argument is that they are saying that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to object to the verdicts or the procedural misconduct, and appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to appeal either of those issues. They don't, as far as my reading, I don't see them raising an argument that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise it ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And I know that's confusing because they were the same attorney.
Well, it's just challenging to see how a trial counsel is going to say that they were ineffective on appeal. I think that that's part of what JAMA is trying to address.
Sure. And so I understand how possibly because I agree that the appellate counsel claim is not NAFLA barred, I understand how, you know, to address that claim, you may need to get into what the trial counsel did as far as objecting during, you know, at the time of the verdicts and during closing argument. And I also, under the second exception to the NAFLA bar, when you're looking at whether fairness requires review, one of the prongs of that is whether there is substantive merit to the underlying claims. So I think under either the ineffective assistance of counsel, appellate counsel claim, or the NAFLA bar exception that has been raised, I understand that we do need to get into the merits a bit to resolve those claims.
Okay.
But I think it's still important, even when we're looking at the merits, to understand the procedural posture we're in.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So getting to the substance, why aren't those two inconsistent with each other?
Sure.
Because, I mean, and I think you heard Pallant's arguments in terms of equating an attempt with a failure to complete the crime versus a completed crime?
Mm-hmm. I believe that the case law is clear from the Cole case as well as the Stewart case that the question is whether an element of the crime negates an element of the other crime. And here, and none of the elements of attempt negate the elements of criminal sexual conduct. As Judge Larson noted, the elements of attempt are the intent to commit the crime and a substantial step towards the commission of the crime.
How do you respond to appellant's argument that State v. Noggle has essentially added a third element, which is that it's not a that attempt is also not a completion? Because I think the point appellant is trying to make that is that case law can also develop what the elements are for a crime. And so how do you respond to the argument that Noggle has said that under our current statute, attempt means that the crime was not completed?
That's not how I read Noggle. Noggle was not dealing with an inconsistent verdict issue. I believe it was dealing with the application of the conditional release statute. And how I think of Noggle is that basically Noggle is saying that attempt and the underlying statutory crime are two separate offenses. And so the conditional release term doesn't apply to a conviction for an attempt. The conditional release statute only applies to a conviction for the statutory offense. And so to me, that's just not very applicable to the analysis that this court needs to do under an inconsistent verdict analysis. I think it's just looking at the elements of this of the two of the crimes and seeing whether one element negates any other element. And I think that's why, the post-conviction court said that an attempted crime is a lesser included of the completed crime. And while I agree with appellant that that does not automatically mean that they are not, that they can't be inconsistent, I think there are some lesser included offenses that can be inconsistent. But it's part of the analysis, and because many lesser included offenses are some of the elements of the crime, but not all of them, and so there isn't another element that would negate an element of the completed crime. And so basically, I think this court just needs to look at the case law and inconsistent verdicts as it stands, apply that case law, look at the elements of the two crimes, and determine that an element is not negated by the other elements of the other crime.
Counsel, do you see this as an issue of first impression that would require a precedential opinion?
I don't see it that way. I mean, I agree that there isn't, I could not find a precedential case on point dealing with attempt specifically. So in that regard, it could be helpful. I hadn't thought about that prior to today, because I do think the case law is clear and it could be decided based on the already established case law. However, setting out the framework that an attempted crime and a completed crime are not legally inconsistent would be helpful in future cases. Because I do think, especially in criminal sexual conduct cases, often completed crimes and attempted crimes are charged together and are tried and presented to the jury together. I think one reason that there aren't many appellate cases on this issue is that because attempt is a lesser included, there's only, even if two guilty verdicts are reached, there's only one conviction, there's only one sentence. And so for appellate issues, it's often not brought to the appellate court for that reason.
Well, if you haven't thought about this issue before, I hate to put you on the spot, but I'm going to. and ask you the same question that I asked opposing counsel for appellant, of if we were to agree with you and issue a presidential opinion, what would you see as the syllabus point? And if you're not... Mm-hmm. If you don't have something clearly formulated, that's okay, but just out of fairness, I want to ask both of you that question.
Sure. I mean, I think in some regards it would be to reiterate the case law that's already established, that to determine whether an attempt is legally inconsistent with the completed crime is to look at the elements of the two offenses. And I think what the clarification that could be helpful is to explicitly say that failure to complete the crime is not an element of attempt. So that's how I would answer that question.
Well, and it's under the existing statute, right? Because you could foresee, so if the legislature, under your analysis, if the legislature changed the attempt statute to require it to be a completed crime, then our court would be left with then looking at the new elements of that crime to determine whether they were legally inconsistent or legally consistent verdicts based on the new iteration of the statute, right? I mean, you're really hanging your hat on this is what the legislature has said attempt is today, is how I understand your argument.
Yes, and hanging my hat on the case law from the appellate court saying how to analyze an inconsistent verdict issue, to look at the elements of the offense. I guess if there aren't any other questions, I would just briefly, since we haven't talked about the prosecutorial misconduct claim at all, first I would just say, you know, again, we need to look through the lens that this is NAFLA barred. It was not, except for one objection, the closing argument was not objected to during trial. These claims were also not raised on direct appeal. And so now, 2 years later, for the first time, there are several claims being raised within the closing argument. And so I would just say that and remind the court that attorneys have considerable latitude in giving closing arguments, and the argument must be considered as a whole rather than taking certain remarks or phrases out of context. And so I would say that as provided in the briefing, the case law is pretty clear that when you look at this through the procedural posture that we're in, as well as the latitude and freedom that attorneys have in closing argument, that there was no misconduct that was committed, and certainly none that was prejudicial and requires a new trial in this case. If there are no other questions, I thank the court for its time today, and we would ask the court to affirm the post-conviction court's denial of the petition for post-conviction relief in this case.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
And if you did just want to touch on your opinion on the application of the recent Gilbert case, I would find that helpful.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you. We would say that Gilbert doesn't apply here. We have, Gilbert is controlling authority, but our case is different than Gilbert. We have demonstrated false testimony with other sources other than an expert opinion, and we've made that very clear in our papers. Again, the state doesn't acknowledge the other evidence that we presented, that the sane nurse testimony was demonstrably false by other sources other than the Kale report. I would also say that the false testimony in this case was assumed to be true, and so this court should look to prong two and not reevaluate whether it was false or not, which the state has asked this court to do. This court, if it's going to reevaluate the falsity of the testimony, Mr. Tichich would be entitled to an evidentiary hearing to present the falsity of the testimony at that hearing.
What is the evidence other than Ms. Kale's testimony to support that the testimony was indeed false?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Sure. It seemed to me that you were relying primarily on Ms. Kale's testimony, the same as was raised in the Gilbert case, and in interest of full disclosure, I was on that panel. But what you said, there's other evidence to show falsity. What is that other evidence?
Absolutely. Well, there's two things that make this different than Gilbert. One is Mrs. Kale's report does not take issue. I would say most of her report is that there is no scientific basis for the opinions, as opposed to her putting in new opinions about what the DNA transfer meant. So that's a difference. In Gilbert, Ms. Kale was making opinions about how the DNA was transferred or not. In this case, Ms. Kale, her report focuses primarily on there is no scientific basis for the two witnesses in this case to be making the statements they did, which is different. The second piece is on the same nurse testimony, which was critical in this case. We have Minnesota versus Well in the Court of Appeals, which we know lip swabs were taken, and the defendant in that case was convicted based on substantial evidence, in quotes, with DNA taken from the lips. We have BCA data that shows that they have, over the last 3 years, gotten DNA samples from lips, and we also have, and we also canvassed case law across the country where lip swabs are taken, DNA is gathered, and so this proposition that the nurse put forth that lip swabs do not yield good evidence, it's important for this case because the proposition the state made was that the DNA from the lip migrated to the paraoral, and that explained both the source, where this came from, and that it was skin. And the same nurse's testimony goes directly to that proposition. And so we have demonstrated in our papers that lip swabs, in fact, do yield good evidence. Ms. Kale's report is just a part of that.
It just strikes me that you're asking an appellate court to make a finding of falsity.
We are not. The post-conviction, to be clear, and that's a great question, to be clear, the post-conviction court assumed for the purposes of the petition that the testimony was false and then went to prong two of Larison. The state has asked you to make a finding that it's not false, and we disagree with that. We don't want you to make a finding. If there needs to be a revisiting of prong one, it should go back to the district court to have an evidentiary hearing. I wanted to come back quickly to legally inconsistent verdicts with my remaining time. While it's true that failure is not an element of the statute of attempt, when the state proved the crime of attempt, they have proven a failed crime. And I want to make one other point very quickly. The lesser included analysis, attempt is not just something that happens when completion is proved. And the lesser included statute 60904 differentiates between attempt and lesser degrees and a crime necessarily proven if the crime charged were proved. And that's an important distinction to look at 60904. And then finally, we would say on the legally inconsistent verdicts, the other fact that cannot be denied is that the reasonable inferences to be drawn from the attempt was that it wasn't completed and that the completion verdict was that it was. And you can't both attempt and fail and complete a crime. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe.
Thank you.